Come to the 64th annual OA birthday party. Together we get better. In person on January 12th to the 14th at the LAX Hilton in Los Angeles, California. Meet fellows from across the globe for a weekend-long extravaganza of workshops, panels, special interest speakers, food, entertainment, fellowship, laughs, and recovery. Highlights include body image workshop, big book study, sober eating workshop, keynote speakers with unique stories covering all aspects of eating disorders, dance party and comedy show, yoga and meditation, meetings and meetups in LGBTQIA, BIPOC, Spanish language, young people, and AAPI members, boutique, shop till you drop, and much, much more. Registration is now open at oabirthday.com. Staying the night? Book your room now at the discounted rate through the oabirthday.com website. Act fast. Rooms sell out quickly. Why? There is a solution. You will hear from speakers who have various versions of this disease who live happy, joyous, and free. Because together we get better.
Welcome to the OA Virtual Kitchen Sink Meeting Podcast. Visit the Los Angeles Intergroup at oalaig.org. for information on how to join our meeting live and how to donate to support this meeting and our podcasts. The opinions expressed on the Kitchen Sink podcast are those of the individual speakers and do not represent OA as a whole. And now, our speaker.
Hi, everybody. Again, I'm a recovered compulsive eater and a member of the Saturday Solutions Group. My name is Gary. So I've been an active member of Overeaters Anonymous since August 1st of 1988. I would love to tell you I've been abstinent for the last 35 years, but I haven't been. I've lost my abstinence 3 times. But like somebody else was just sharing, I haven't eaten sugar or flour. Well, I eat flour. I haven't eaten sugar or any of the crap that I don't, any of the stuff I don't eat. Sorry. I haven't eaten any of the stuff I don't eat in over 35 years. But that's so if this was Sugars Anonymous, I'd be like a superstar. Unfortunately, it's Overeaters Anonymous, and I have overeaten. So, ta-da. What's happened is a few times I've lost my abstinence by overeating the stuff that I do eat. I just ate more of what I do eat. There's a line in the book Beyond Our Wildest Dreams where Roseanne talks about nibbling our way back to obesity. And that's kind of, I didn't get obese, but I gained back, one time I gained back almost 30 pounds. When I came in, I stopped weighing myself at 340 pounds. So I now weigh a little bit less than half of what I weighed when I'm half the man I used to be. So I don't know how much I weighed. Like I said, I stopped weighing. At one point, I gained back some weight. I remember saying to a friend of mine, thinking I was, that's how delusional you get. I thought I was abstinent because I wasn't eating any crap. I wasn't eating any of the stuff I don't eat. So I said to my friend Teresita, I said, I don't know what's going on. I'm gaining weight, but I'm abstinent. And she said to me, well, if you're gaining weight, what are you abstaining from? Because clearly it's not overeating like that. And of course, my first reaction was to punch her in the throat. But I didn't. I didn't. And I went home and thought about it. And of course, she's right. I mean, here's the thing, and I don't mean to disappoint anybody, but if you're gaining real weight, you're probably overeating. unless you've got some weird medical thing going on, that's kind of how it works. If you're gaining weight, you're probably overeating. And it's not happy news, but I have to say, in a way, a lot of us do love each other to death that way. We watch each other gain weight. We watch each other, and we're afraid of saying. The weird thing is, people outside of OA say things like that to each other all the time. They say things like, "Hey, man, you seem to be gaining weight. I wonder what's going on." Whereas in OA, I have said to lots of people, who seem to be gaining weight, can I be of help? Is there something happening? Are you working with your sponsor? There's nothing wrong. We used to call it, in the old days, we used to call it carefrontation, and it's not a bad thing to do, to address each other about fat serenity. It's not a bad thing to do. It's a very loving thing to do. I've been in OA, like I said, over 35 years, and I've known 16 people who've died of eating disorders. I've known more people, I'm in two other fellowships, I've known more people to die of eating disorders than of other addictions. I know more people die of other addictions in general, but the people I've known more people have died of eating disorders. And the truth is, and I'm sorry to say this at the beginning of a meeting, the vast majority of people with eating disorders die with them, you know, of them, not just with them, but of them. It is very rare to be even offered the opportunity to recover in OA. And if you've noticed, most people who come here don't stay. We are a statistical anomaly. Those of us who stay here and recover here and get well here, we're a statistical anomaly. It's a rarity and an honor and a privilege to have what we have. And what a blessing, man. So thank you, God, to be among the chosen, really. And anyhow, I'm not telling my story. I'm preaching. So what happened is I decided to commit suicide. That's the thing. I decided to commit suicide in 1988. And I had made some minor attempts at suicide before, but what happened was 5 years before I got to OA, I went on a diet and I lost 115 pounds. On my diet, I lost 115 pounds and I was thin for like 6 or 7 minutes. And I was in graduate school in Ohio at the time, and I flew to New York. It was in my family, when you're thin for 6 or 7 minutes, you fly around and show everybody so they know you're a good boy. So I flew to New York to show my father that I was a good boy because I was thin. And he saw that I was thin. He said, "You're a good boy. You're thin." And I stopped at a deli and I picked up an inordinate amount of food. And seemingly within a couple of days, gained back 130 pounds from the 115 that I lost. It just all of a sudden I'm pounding the bar. How did it happen? How did this happen? And yeah, just, again, somehow I was 130 pounds heavier. And after I gained back that weight, I just gave up. I just completely surrendered to my disease, didn't even try to diet anymore, and knew my future was going to be, I was going to become one of those guys where they had, like, you just eat until you're too huge to get out the door, and they have you die, and they have to cut the doors open, you know, like you see on TV, but they have to cut the doors open and pull you out with a wench and then bury you in some, you know, horse thing. I just knew that was my future. I surrendered to it. And I decided to commit suicide. 4 years later, I decided to commit suicide. I was in academics. I'm a retired college professor, and I was in academics. And in academics, the years start in August. So I decided to commit suicide in August. And I said, if nothing changes by August, I'll commit suicide. And somehow, I don't know how. To this day, I don't know how, other than the grace of God and active providence, I ended up in treatment August 1st of 1988. I don't know how. I ended up in a treatment center. And that night, they took me to my first OA meeting. And I didn't like the meeting very much. I thought it was kind of cutesy with all the hugging and the, you know, I didn't like it very much. But the speaker was the guy who became my first sponsor. And he talked about something I had never heard before in my whole life. I've done all kinds of diets. I'd never heard this before. He said, he talked about having the obsession removed. And I had never heard that before. And I heard that and I said, that's a shot. If I could have the obsession removed, I have a shot. And I believe this is over 35 years ago. And I believe that today, that my only shot, my only chance is to have the obsession removed. And if I can, and that's what happened, you know, got to the 10th, 11th, 12th steps. And those three steps, the obsession is removed. And that's how I live today. And that's because if I have to live with the obsession, sooner or later, I'm going to eat. That's the truth. That's the bottom line. But, you know, if I have to live with the obsession, sooner or later, it's going to win. I think, I might be wrong, but I think that's why it's called an obsession. Obsessions win. Anyhow, so we started working the steps. We did the first step. I wrote my history like many of you did when you do your. Here's my favorite first step story. My favorite first step story. I was living in the Caribbean with my father. I was a teenager. And he was living in the Caribbean. I come from a long line of criminals. My father was a criminal. My grandfather was a criminal. I was a criminal. And my father was living in the Caribbean, hiding from the federal authorities. And I was there hiding from the New York State authorities. I was going to reform school, what they used to call reform school, is jail for teenagers. And I was hiding from them. And My father, it's not for me to call him a compulsive eater or not, but he was definitely a glutton. He was definitely a glutton, and he was going through one of those phases where he didn't want to eat, because he knew what I knew. Once he got started, he wasn't going to stop. So he got rid of all the food in the house. There was no food, and I was having a carb craving. And if you're like me, if you know what a craving, like I experience a craving like a need. I experience a craving like oxygen. Like I have to have it. So there was no food, and I was having this craving, and I had a thought. And it's always, that's where it starts. It's always a thought. If you read the chapter more about alcoholism, you'll see there are four stories, including the jaywalker. And in each one of those stories, it starts with a thought. The guy with the milk suddenly had a thought. The guy who retired suffered from the belief that the jaywalker can't get the jaywalking idea out of his head. It always starts with, anyhow, I had a thought. And the thought was we had no food, but we had a German Shepherd. And the German Shepherd had milk bones, which were dog biscuits, and the dog biscuits were carbs. So I had a thought. My second thought was, you can't eat those. Those are disgusting. And I was right. They were disgusting. And the second one wasn't any better. Nor the third, nor the fourth, nor the fifth. They were disgusting. And I ate them anyway. First time I told that story was at a newcomer meeting, and there were these women there, probably younger than I am now, but I thought of them as elderly, and they went like this. They went like that. I remember thinking, man, that must be bad if you can meet people in OA go, because you guys have all eaten out of garbage cans and stuff. So anyhow, on the way out of the meeting, I asked my friend Maxine if that was disgusting or not, and she said it's only really disgusting if you had to wrestle them away from the dog. Because here's the thing, and here's the point of the story, and here's why it's a first step story. And if you're a newcomer or you're a sponsor, here's the thing you want to know. I ate those dog biscuits because I had no choice. Nobody eats dog biscuits out of choice. If I had any choice in the world, I would not have eaten those dog biscuits. That's why, so that's what the first step means. I am powerless. It means I am going to be, by my obsession, by my compulsion, I am going to be driven to do things that I would never do if I had a choice. I sponsored a guy who weighed 700 pounds. Nobody weighs 700 pounds out of choice. Nobody, when they're a child, says, when I grow up, I want to weigh 700 pounds. That's what it means to be powerless. I was powerless over dog biscuits, man. That's my, and my life is unmanageable because the first step has dashes. It doesn't have a colon, semicolon. So it's not like I'm powerless and my life is unmanageable. It means it's a restatement. It's in a, grammatically, it's called an appositive. It's like saying Gary Davis, that bald guy. So it's a restatement. I'm powerless and my life is unmanageable. We got to the second step, and I wasn't a believer. I wasn't an atheist. I wasn't agnostic. I take that 3 minutes to be 3 minutes until the 5 minutes. Is that right? Yeah, okay. So we got to the second step, and I wasn't, like I said, I wasn't an atheist. I just was obnoxious. I was just extremely obnoxious. And I was going to argue whatever side you were on, I was going to argue the other side. My sponsor was a believer, so I was arguing with him why there's no God. It can't be God. Holocaust, all the stuff your sponsees argue with you about why there's no God. And he said something that was so important to me. I always like to pass it on, especially if you're a sponsor. He said, I don't give a hoot what you believe. Who cares what you believe? He said, you're an active addict. And it's true, like compulsive eaters really believe there's a hierarchy of addiction. Like nobody would go over to a heroin addict with a needle hanging out of his arm and say, tell me, Mr. Heroin Addict, what's your theology? Is there a God? Is there an afterlife? No, but compulsive eaters think because we're just food addicts, we can pontificate on the nature of the universe and if there's a God or not. He said, I don't care what you believe. He said, if you want to get well, it is your job to come to believe this. Find a way. He said, find a way. Find a way to believe that there's a God that can restore your sanity. There's a higher power that can restore your sanity. He said, just keep your antenna up. And he went like that. He said, keep your antenna up. He said, look for evidence of a loving God that can restore you to sanity. And that's what I did. And that's what I still do. I still do that today. I'm always looking for evidence of a loving God. And the more I look, the more I keep finding it. I keep finding more and more evidence of a God that loves me. And I have to tell you, I don't know if God has a refrigerator or not, but if he does, I'm sure there's a picture of me on it because my life just keeps getting better and better and better. It's remarkable, man. It's just an incredible thing. So yeah, I believe in a loving God that just really loves me and just takes care of me. And even the littlest things, even the tiniest little things keep going my way. And the more I listen to them, I'm trying to wrap my head around God's pronouns. I know it's not he. I know it's not, I'm a 20th century guy, so this pronoun stuff kind of throws me off a lot. I have trouble with it. So whatever pronouns you would use for God, I guess it's a they, but it's still hard for me to say it. But they just love the they just love me, man. Unbelievably, I imagine they love you as well. I imagine, but I know they love me. I just know it. I feel it deep in my heart, and I have so much evidence for it. My life is fantastic. I mean, my life is fantastic. Even when my life is terrible, it's fantastic. And I was such a mean, angry, pissed off guy. I was just always like, I was just an argument looking to happen. I get it, Deb. I got 5 minutes and
Yeah,
20
you've got five. Yep.
seconds. Yeah.
Perfect.
I can see your little thing. It's wonderful. We came, so having done that, we came to the third step. And man, we came to the third step. And when I was in treatment, there was this therapist who just came back from India. And so I knew she was holy because she was in India. Because I don't know if you know this, but apparently God lives in India. Not so much in Brooklyn, but in India. So she came back from India and she was wearing a lot of linen and Birkenstocks and kind of floating around the place. And so I got on my knees with my sponsor and we hold hands. And her name was Mallory. So I said, God, I'm a friend of Mallory's, because I wanted him to know that I had connection, that I wasn't just some schmuck, I'm a friend of Mallory's. And then I still get a little choked up when I think about this moment. It's so intimate to do the third step. I don't know what it's like for women. I assume it's similar, but for me, as a guy with another guy holding hands, and we were in the in this church thing. There was this church in Miami Shores where there's this big cross, and you can go into the cross. You're actually sitting inside the cross, and inside the cross, and we're on our knees. And I said, I'm a friend of Mallory's. And I don't know where the words came from, but I said, Dear God, if it be your will, redeem me, make me new. And redemption isn't part of my lexicon. It's not part of my upbringing. It's not part of my background. I was raised Jewish-ish. I'm now a Christian. I became a Christian a few years ago. But it's part of the development of my spiritual path. It's a whole nother story. I was raised Jewish, and redemption isn't really. Anyhow, I was raised without religion. My religion was really Frank Capra movies. I said, "Redeem me, make me new," and it just choked up in me. It just came out of nowhere, and then we did the third step prayer, and here's what happened. And I don't mean to sound cocky, but God redeemed me. He made me new. In the big book, it says sometimes a great effect is felt at once in the third step, and I'm one of those people. Just the decision to live by spiritual principles changed me. And I said, like, I was a criminal. I was always looking at what I can get away with. And the decision to live by spiritual principles made me a new man. And I don't want to give anybody the wrong impression. The 12 steps are miraculous, but they're not magical. It's not like boom, I was turned into somebody else. It's just, what happened in taking the third step is that God gave me the willingness and the desire to live and work the remaining 11 steps, or the remaining 9 steps. He didn't give me math. He gave me, the ability to do the steps. So he gave me the willingness and the ability to do the remaining 9 steps and the desire to do so. And in doing so, I was redeemed. I became somebody else. And in doing so, I had a spiritual awakening of a particular type that enabled me to no longer want to eat compulsively, to remove the obsession, remove the desire. It gave me, I live in a position where I'm able to do a lot of service. And somebody told me, Kim G, I don't know if I assume some of you know her. She says, She says that if you're not living in 10 and 11, you're using 12 as a drug. And that really resonated with me. And I live in 10 and 11, and I practice 12 a lot. And through that, the obsession is removed, and I get to live just. And I just want, in the last minute, I just want to say something that, you know, you hear a lot about working the steps, and my recovery has never asked me to do anything as difficult as my disease has asked me to do. I have to tell you, the 12-step way of life is just a delightful way of life. It is so joyful. It is so much fun. It is just, it is a great way of life. I mean, I don't know anybody who lives this way who isn't happy. I don't know anybody who's ever asked for their money back. God, this program, and you people have not just given me a life, you have given me a life worth living. If there's ever anything I could do to return the favor, please let me know. Thank you so much for letting me ramble on for 20 minutes. This is the time for questions only, and I assume answers. There will be no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any one of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leader are my own and do not and are not those of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole. When asking questions, you need not identify yourself. If you asked a question last week, please wait until the first three questions have been asked before raising your hands. If you have a question, please click the raise your hand icon. I just need to clarify something because I'm new to this meeting. So somebody asks a question, and do I answer the question or does the group answer? I answer the question.
Yes.
Okay. Are there any questions? Please do your electronic raise your hand thing if you have a question. Yeah, Deb.
Gary, thank you so much. So can you talk about your amends process, considering you kind of shared a little bit about what your life was like before recovery? So, you know, I was just kind of thinking about that. It was the first thing that popped in my head. Thank you.
My process is pretty much the same process as everybody's. I would say the main thing is I do a real, before doing the ninth step, I did a really thorough eighth step. And I advocate that a lot. If you do a thorough eighth step, the ninth step is pretty easy. I mean, it's painful. It's painful to write big checks. It's painful to have to talk to somebody you have weird feelings with. And in the 10th step, it's, you know, it's, it does feel good to clean up my mess, to know, you know, it sounds like it's a chore, but you know, the vast majority of people in the last 30 seconds of their lives go like, oh, damn, I left, you know, like we have this blessing of knowing that when we come to the end, pretty much we've cleaned up our mess. I mean, that's really such a blessing. Between the 9th and 10th steps, we're, you know, like, we're going to go pretty clean. There are some people I've only been able to make amends to. There are people I've hurt anonymously. And there are, you know, there are people I've stolen from that I've had to make indirect amends. And there are two people I've hurt where all, every sponsor I've ever had said it would be harmful for me to seek them out, that the best I can do is remain open to the possibility of them seeking me out and making amends if they ever sought me out. I will tell an eighth and ninth step story. It's a little bit long, but I want to share this because it's important as a man. I come from a horribly abusive background. I could have died at the hands of either of my parents. I've been sexually abused, physically abused, and emotionally abused. I got to the eighth step and I said to my sponsor, look, I'm about to make amends. I stole some money from my parents here and there. I went into their purse, went into their pockets, took some money. I disappeared on them for a couple of years, a couple of times. But they did this. You know, like, you go to jail for what they did. They did this. I did this. You know, they did, like, and I said, this, you know, it really seemed disproportionate. My mother once threw an iron at my head and it landed like here, 2 inches over, I'd be blind, you know, like a hot iron. No, yeah, it was awful. And she's like, oh, I know, I'm not trying to get you said, like, this is the kind of thing I would tell people in a bar and they would buy me a drink. So don't feel too sorry for me. Believe me, I bled this thing enough. Believe me, I bled my abuse for every inch of milk I could get from it. So anyhow, I said this to my sponsor in the eighth step, and I said, they did this. And my sponsor said something to me that I found so ridiculous. He said, why don't you just forgive them? Like that. He said it, and he said it casually, like as if, why don't you just levitate? And I just heard that like it was, you know, absurd. And I am not telling anybody here who's been abused to forgive. That's entirely between you, your God, and your sponsor. That's entirely up to you. But then he said something that really changed my life. He said, forgiveness is simply giving up your right to revenge. That's all it is. It doesn't mean, it says, if somebody's not safe, they're not safe. Like if somebody steals your car and you forgive them, that doesn't mean you lend them the keys to your car again. Like you're spiritual, you're not stupid. You know, so it just means giving up your right to revenge. You no longer have to get even with them. And that meant in my case, like I always thought if my parents ever came to me and said, I'm sorry for what I did, I could forgive them. This means they don't even need to recognize their bad behavior, just giving up my right to revenge. And that's what I did. I gave up my right to revenge. And I have to tell you, it healed my family. My mother and I were very, I was with her throughout the last days of her life. I stayed with her in the hospital. I nurtured her. I actually did a third step with my mother where she met God. But, you know, I held her hands while she met God and cried. And my father and I had the best relationship available to us before he died. I love them both. And I'm just saying that was my experience. Giving up my right to revenge. Anyhow, thank you. And I hope that answers your question. Cheryl.
Hi, Gary. Thank you for your very interesting and eventful share. You can be a criminal and still be rigorously honest. The two can coexist. My question to you is this. Your clean, rigorous honesty, were you always like that? Or did that result as, you know, of working the program?
Oh, from working the program. I was a very dedicated liar. Very dedicated liar. I would lie just for practice or for fun. Yeah.
Maybe you can expound on that process.
Of becoming rigorously honest? Yeah. Like everybody else, I joined OA and I didn't want to eat anymore. And I was told that I can't remember who, when Pamela read How It Works, it said anybody, even people with severe mental and emotional handicaps, can recover if they have the capacity to be honest. In the beginning, I wasn't even all that honest. I certainly wasn't rigorously honest. I was as honest as I could be. And that's all it takes. And even says, it says even those who aren't all that honest, their chances are less than average. It doesn't say you're hopeless. It doesn't even say you're helpless. It says just to be as honest as you can be. And that's enough to be at least, you know, your chances are less than average. But that doesn't mean you don't have a chance. You still have a chance. Be as honest as you can be. And like every other skill, you know, like I said, I've been doing this 35 years. Like skills get better with practice. You know, surrender is a skill. Honesty is a skill. All the things we need to recover, we get better at as we practice them. Just like lying, you know, like I started lying probably when I was like 3 years old, that kind of stuff. And by the time I was 34 when I came into OA. And by the time I got here, I was pretty good at it. Listen, I don't think you can be any kind of successful addict without being a good liar. I don't know how you like. How can you be a good at? How can you be successful at any addictive behavior without being a liar and a thief and a con artist? I mean, at least lying to yourself. I hope that answers your question. But I've never met an honest addict. I mean, any of you have sponsored? Your sponsees don't lie to you? I mean, mine do. I lied to my sponsor. I hope that answers your question. Ellie?
Thank you, Gary. During your lead, you talked about evidence of a loving God. I too have a loving God. Can you point to some concrete pieces of evidence of your loving higher power? Thank you.
Well, I suppose the biggest is having the obsession removed. I mean, that would be the biggest piece of evidence. But it ranges from everything to finding a parking spot. Like, I think God, you know, I was taught early on when I get stuck in traffic, to remember that I'm probably avoiding an accident. You know, when I get stuck behind, when I'm in a rush and the light is red, that if the light was green, I probably would have gotten in an accident. I was single for a long time in OA and dated a lot. And I remember being taught rejection is God's protection. Because a few times I've ended up with the woman I really wanted. And man, was that a bad idea. I guess simply having a grateful heart, you know, I have to pray for a grateful heart. It doesn't come naturally to me. Self-pity is a really, has always been a go-to for me, a go-to attitude. And I guess simply having the change in attitude that I've experienced through recovery is part of that loving God for me. Trying to think, there's so much. I love coffee in the morning. I love quiet time in the morning. I love the fact that I love those things, that I spend quiet time in the morning with my God and like that is, who is that guy? One day I was driving to a meeting on I-95 in Florida and the traffic came to a stop. And my first thought was, oh my God, I hope nobody was hurt. And that was my first thought. Usually my first thought would be, oh my God, why do these things happen to me? Why does this happen to me? Traffic comes to a stop and doesn't. And that change in me, that change in attitude was such a godly thing. All of that. Just having just a joyous life. All of that. Ellie, you're nodding your head, so I'm getting the feeling that you know exactly what I'm talking about. So
I do. It was a tough question, and I thank you.
Thank you. Leslie, what time is it?
Hi, thank you. Thanks for your share. I think I have like 3 questions in one, so I'm going to try to verbalize it, articulate it. So you talked about letting go of the sugar and then still being in kind of in not in being in relapse or not being in abstinence. What does that journey look like? Like being free of the obsession of like kind of the thing that's killing you and then still using other stuff. So that, and then like, what does the food plan look like? Like, how did you know what to let go of, or did the behaviors just lift?
Well, I mean, part of it is, like I said, the name of the place is Overeaters Anonymous. That's the name of the place. But also, like, if you've been to, if you've been to a dozen meetings, you've noticed that we're different people and the eating disorder shows up differently for different people. Some of us really are just addicted to certain substances. And we relate to sugar and white flour, some of us, the way the alcoholic relates to alcohol. But you'll notice alcoholics still drink. They just don't drink alcohol. So some of us still eat. We just don't eat certain substances. For me, I have to say, in addition to being substance sensitive, I'm also a volume addict. That is, if I overeat anything, it'll kick up the phenomenon of craving for me. That doesn't seem to be true of everybody. I don't know, but it's certainly true for me. Broccoli for me is not an addictive substance. But if I overeat broccoli today, tomorrow I will want to overeat sweet potatoes. And if I overeat sweet potatoes tomorrow, I'm going to want to eat sweet potatoes every day. And if I want to eat sweet potatoes every day, sooner or later I will want my substance of choice. And it's just what seems to be true for me is that overeating itself is as much a addictive practice as substances. Basically, in addiction theory, in addiction treatment, this is not just about overeating. There are two types of addictions. There are substance addictions like heroin and alcohol and And then there are process addictions like gambling, and some people put overeating in that category, that overeating, like bulimia. Bulimia is both a substance addiction and it is a process addiction. Some people, and I'm sure that there are bulimics here who will tell you that they get addicted to the process of purging as much as they do to the process of overeating. For me, I get just as much addicted to the process of overeating as I do to the substances that I overeat. So for me, overeating becomes its own problem. So I need to keep track of how much I don't measure so much as I weigh, because measuring, I can lie when I measure. Like, you know, how much food fits into a cup, how much food can be crammed into a cup depends upon my mood. So I tend to weigh. So what the process looks like for me is, like somebody was asking about lying before, when it comes to food, I'm still not trustworthy. I'm still full of crap. That's what it is. So I have to be careful around that stuff. And so I'm just saying, this is what it's like for me. In addition to substances, I have to be careful about volume. I'm also a volume addict. And again, the name of the place is Overeaters Anonymous. If it was Sugars Anonymous, it would be a whole different deal. My abstinence would be a little bit simpler. I hope that answers your question. And again, that's for me. That's not a way.
Thank you.
Melissa, you got 2 minutes.
Well, this will be quick. Thank you so much for your share. It was really powerful, Gary. Can you explain to us what your daily spiritual practice looks like, how you connect to your loving higher power? Thanks.
I do everything it says in the book. I do the prayer, the meditation in the morning. I do upon awakening. I go throughout the day. I talk to God. I do all that stuff. I do the nighttime thing. I do a journal. A lot of I use Region 7's journal because I like it the most. This is the Region 7 one. But Region 2 has one. Region 1 has one. Region 8 has one, where it has your food and has the questions, you know, like, were you resentful? Were you, you know, like, a bunch of the regions have one. If you just go to their webpage, I think you're in Region 2, right, in California? All right. Yeah, I think they have one. A lot of the regions have one. But I do all the stuff it says, and I talk to God all day. He's like, I said, I'm a Christian. I talk to Christ. I just like that. He's one of my best friends. He probably is my best friend. Next to my wife and my and God, I'm like, we hang out all day. That's what I do. I mean, I do all the stuff it says in the book. Plus, this is fun. I got to tell you, it's not work. It's fun. It's like hanging out with God is a good time. It's a good time. In the big book, it says the bright spot of our day is talking to the newcomer and each other. I would add God to that equation. And why not? What do you got to lose?